involved here. But as in all cases, when a country is under sanctions, there are elements in that country, and in this case, in particular, the Iranian Revolutionary Guards, who are making great deals of money from the sanctions because they have the monopoly on breaking the sanctions. When the distortions that are introduced into an economy when it's under sanctions make some people there very rich, even though the population as a whole in Iran, for example, is seriously suffering. So that plays into Iranian internal conflicts, of course. It's not like we should be looking for who are the good guys in these conflicts among states, regional powers, and so forth. There are no good guys. There are interests of states and regimes, and in particular, ruling classes and ruling elites. And as I said, in this particular case, there is a tactical rupture between what U.S. elites and the current government of Israel want.
Dave Finkel, let's conclude. This is Bill Resnick for the Old Mole on KABU 90.7 FM, Portland, Oregon. We've been talking about Israel, the U.S., and and now the differences that are showing up in their special relationship. It seems to me the negotiations with there's a number of things. There's Israel's declining legitimacy across the entire Western world, and particularly in the United States, as exemplified in the BDS movement. And also these negotiations with Iran that could, in fact, lead to some kind of settlement of the Syrian mess, horrible displacement of people and deaths. What do you see as those possibilities?
Well, I mean, if you want to end on some kind of hopeful note, let me point to two things. First of all, despite the terrible defeats of the democratic uprising in Egypt, and the fact that democratic uprisings have been beaten back in so many places, Egypt, Syria, Iran, Libya, all these disasters, the spirit, the desire for democracy, reform, and particularly dignity that fueled the Arab Spring, those have not disappeared, and they will reemerge. Although the present situation, as I said, we have to try to just get our minds around how really horrible in human and social terms the present situation is. Secondly, as you mentioned, the BDS movement is terribly important. That relates to the issue not of Iran, Syria, and so forth, but the question of Israel and Palestine. The BDS movement is the is really the best, and at this point the only real lever that we have for pushing the issue of the Israeli occupation and the demand for Palestinian rights into the public agenda and having some impact. We haven't been discussing Palestine here. It's a whole big issue. Unfortunately, it is not an issue of major strategic interest to the United States, which is why Israel gets pretty much a free hand to carry on its rampages in the occupied territories. But BDS is the best way we have of raising that issue. That's boycott, divestment, sanctions, and I hope that people, organizations, congregations, communities, and so on will take part in that movement according to what makes sense for them and what their own social justice principles are.
Dave Finkel, thanks a lot for talking to us today.
Thank you.
Underdog, 1967, Sly and the Family Stone. This is the Old Mole Variety Hour on KBOO's KBOO FM 90.7. Later in our program, we'll have The Left and the Law with a discussion on the state of death penalty politics, and Tom Becker reads an article on exclusivity and exceptionalism in America, linking drones, Petraeus, and the death of Freddie Gray. Next on The Old Mole, Larry Bolden reviews Faye Weldon's 2010 novel, Shalcott Crescent. Larry?
Good morning. I love reading the current works of the authors I've been reading for the past 50 years. Faye Weldon's 2010 novel, Shalcott Crescent, displays the same brilliant and humorous cynicism of her early novels. So many of the novels I've read in the past 6 months or so have been works that attempt to sum up the past century, or more accurately, the past 50 years. Unlike many of the other writers, Weldon explicitly says that this is a summing-up novel. Quote, "Okay, let's get it over. There is a lot to be told in the tale of the last 50 years," close quote. But as she sums up, she also predicts, and so there's a dystopian flavor to this novel. Weldon describes the London of the present time and a projection into the future, after the failure of the banks and the crumbling of capitalism, a time when NUG, National Unity Government, is in control of daily life. Quoting again from the book, "The shock in October 2008, and after that the crunch, and the crisis, and the phony recovery, like the phony war, and then the squeeze, and inflation, and now the bite, and the rest is history, or the future," close quote. She envisions it as a time when most homes have been abandoned by owners who could no longer make their payments. Most cars sit on the street, abandoned, no petrol, and no owners. The heroine of the story, coincidentally a famous or once famous author, is still in her home, but the bailiffs are at the door, pounding, returning every few minutes, wanting to serve her with the papers that say she must leave, that the home is no longer hers. She refuses to answer the door, to accept the summons. She huddles on the steps where she cannot be seen, a grandson at her side who is a member of Red Peace, a resistance group that is recognized by the state but carefully monitored. As always with Weldon, even when she's describing the grimmest of scenes, the worst sorts of misfortune, there is sparkling humor in her writing. I have to confess I'm sometimes put off by the juxtaposition of dystopian predictions and humor. Deriving humor from tragedy bothers me even when I'm laughing along with her. Like her heroine, Weldon is now in her 80s, looking back over a life of writing and political activism. Her early novels, she's published 34, were usually about women caught in oppressive marriages in the British patriarchy. Shalcott Crescent also has a lot to say about sexism and feminism, but looking back over 50 years, she's also often critical of some purported feminist claims. Let me quote a few passages that will make manifest both her humor and her insightfulness. "These days, the young take their sexual relationships seriously. People have a useful habit of turning disadvantages to advantages. Only when AIDS made promiscuity dangerous did fidelity become fashionable, at least among the educated classes. 15 years previously, since the advent of the pill and widespread contraception, sexual adventure had been looked at favorably. Now, sexual restraint turned from a bore into a virtue." Close quote. She continues speaking of the open marriages of the past, quote, "Sexual jealousy was considered beneath contempt, which suited men rather more than it did women, and was one of the reasons, along with men's assumption that we would make the coffee and do the secretarial work, that we moved over into feminism, invented the concept of sexism, and the rest of it is social history." Close quote. Besides her many asides on feminism, Weldon also pokes fun at fiction writing and her own career, even to the point of suggesting that perhaps her beleaguered heroine deserves her fate for making and then spending so much money in the past. She has advice for both writers and readers that I find perceptive and liberating. Again, quoting, "If you've got this far, reader, you've got your money's worth. Don't even bother to skip. Throw it away in disgust if this is how it takes you. Really, there is no obligation to get to the end of a book which annoys you." Close quote. She continues with advice that I wholeheartedly endorse. Quote, I am always concerned when people finding out that I am a writer apologize and say, "Oh, I'm not much of a reader, actually. I know I ought to, but I just don't seem able to find the time," and then go on to tell me how they feel obliged to finish any book they begin. "Well, of course," I say, "you'll be reluctant to open one in the first place, knowing what it might entail. It isn't meant to be like that, I assure you. If you begin a book and you don't like it, just throw it away. Or take it round to a charity shop. It's like going to a party. Some people you linger with, knowing you get on. Some people you exchange greetings with and move on fast. It's nothing against them. They're just not your kind of person. It's the same with books. You must be prepared to discard. Close quote. Excellent advice. And this may be one of the books you discard. Although critical of capitalism and seeming still in line with her previous leftist views, there's something a bit too cynical about this book. The critiques of present society, perceptive and well thought out, but providing little in the way of pointing where we might go from here. This novel may be more autobiographical than most of her novels. I think it is no mistake that the age of her lead character is very like her own, and Weldon's own career in advertising as well as her writing career seem to be closely parallel that of her protagonist. At any rate, Weldon is a powerful as well as a humorous writer, and I think she would agree with the sentiments of her protagonist. Quote, I will be really sorry to leave this life as soon as I must. It is so full of wonder as well as horror. A surprise around every corner, and the place is hotting up. Close quote. Just so, and how wonderful we still have her to help us understand it. I've been talking about Faye Weldon's novel, Chalcott Crescent. This is Larry Bolden for the Old Mole Variety Hour.
More action. More excitement. More everything.
Good evening, ladies and gentlemen.
Across space.
Step right up and step off the train.
The land before time.
Welcome to America.
All the freaks are here.
All you have to do is make a promise.
I promise.
And stay on the grind.
You give it to me, I'll give it to you.
30,000 megawatts of power, baby. Radiating your soul.
Sign right here on the dotted line.
Come on, get you some free.
I promise.
Ladies and gentlemen, before exiting the train,
I promise.
Please leave your valuables.
That is Erykah Badu, American Promise. Next on The Old Mole, we have The Left and the Law with Jan Hocken and Mike Snedeker discussing the current state of death penalty politics. Jan and Mike?
Well, last week, the United States Supreme Court began review of Oklahoma's three-drug execution protocol. The primary question posed by the case, the Glossop versus Gross case, involves deciding on how to kill people and whether the current cocktail used in several states meets criteria established by the Constitution to avoid cruel and unusual punishment. Mike, tell us a little about this case and what's at stake in picking the right drugs to kill people.
Well, it's all part of an effort to medicalize executions, to make it seem like it's not that extraordinary a thing, and it's the sort of thing that all of us will come to in our final moments, and to avoid the fact that it's a bloody, brutal business.
There's been a change in the drugs. Drugs have been used for how long for executions in the U.S.?
Well, there's a three-judge court ruling on a three-drug cocktail that was invented by the Oklahoma legislature.
Even the term cocktail is a bit misleading, right?
Well, sort of. It was invented by the Oklahoma legislature in the late 70s and then adopted all over the country and has been used in some 1,300 executions ever since. But European drug companies have bought up all the major pharmaceutical companies in this country.
Another story for another day.
Yes. And one of the major, the drugs are a sedative and then a paralytic, which makes it impossible to complain or express yourself or move at all. And finally, potassium chloride, which will stop your heart and creates a feeling or a sensation of intense burning, which led to a question by Justice Kagan during oral arguments on the case, which is called Glossop v. Gross, to the Oklahoma Attorney General, is could we burn people at the stake? Is there any reason why? You know, why are we not doing that?
Now, as I understand it, this combination of drugs currently in use in the U.S. it's difficult to monitor and predict the potassium chloride or the effects of the drugs that are intended to bring about death, and the paralytic makes it difficult to know whether the person is suffering in the process, and it's more to protect observers from the brutality and the suffering of an execution. So as I understand it, that's one of the key issues, is this one particular drug that's related to Valium that makes it difficult to express the pain or to communicate to the doctors administering it that there is a problem with bringing about death.
Well, the problem is the sedative. Now, the sedative that used to be used was sodium thiopental, but you can't get that anymore except in back alleys, which is where the states of Arizona and Oklahoma have been obtaining it, and Georgia. And their friends in the legislature have passed laws banning the press from finding out or eliminating any requirement that they disclose what they're using.
They can be drug dealers when they need to or want to.
Absolutely. So they're now using, because they can't get what they've been using before, a new drug called midazolam, which has a lot of problems as an anesthetic. Apparently it has a ceiling effect, which means there is a point beyond which if you give more and more and more, you're not going to add to the anesthetic effect. And there was a badly botched execution in Oklahoma, which is probably the basis of the court revisiting this issue, where somebody was jammed with needles 12, 14 times. Finally, a vein near his groin was found. It was Clayton Lockett was his name. It took 2 or 3 hours. He was, after declared unconscious, he reared up and said, "Man, this shit is messing with me. He was complaining. He was saying things. He said, you know, something's gone wrong." He was making these plaintive statements, and was altogether a disaster. So Oklahoma is now coming back around with a new plan, and that new plan is what the U.S. Supreme Court is discussing.
Now, is there a parallel with the debate that also was in the news last week with the American Psychological Association being so involved and evidence quite clear, the high level of involvement in authorizing psychologists to participate in interrogation practices in places like Guantanamo to make sure that these practices were administered in a humane way, and that now this is regarded by most clinicians as unethical, that even your participation creates a certain legitimacy or illusion of medical medical compliance with the ethics of the profession. Is there a risk here too of even participating in which drugs can be most effectively used in compliance with the Constitution's ban on cruel and unusual punishment, that this is, even to engage in this debate, sidesteps the most fundamental moral issue?
Well, it does. And the Chief Justice of the Ninth Circuit, Judge Kuczynski, made very strong points in a dissenting opinion in the Wood case, where he said, you know, the whole need to carry out executions medically is a misguided effort to mask their brutality, because people do resist. There is a biological clinging to life that the drugs cannot reliably take care of. He says it's an effort to mask their brutality by medicalizing them, but they're basically brutal and savage events. Nothing the state tries to do can mask that reality, nor should it. He said if states and federal government wish to continue carrying out the death penalty, they must turn away from this misguided path and return to the more primitive and foolproof methods of execution. The guillotine is probably best, but is inconsistent with our national ethos. The electric chair, hanging, gas chambers, all are subject to mishaps. The firing squad, he says, strikes me as the most promising. 8 or 10 large caliber rifle bullets fired at close range could inflict massive damage, causing instant death every time. There are plenty of people employed by the state who can pull the trigger and have the training to aim true. Sure, firing squads can be messy, but if we are willing to carry out executions, we should not shield ourselves from the reality that we are shedding human blood.
And this, the history of the death penalty is really a history about this very process of legitimizing or shielding the violence of the state through enlisting the professions, the medical profession being one. And Guillotin was a doctor, Dr. Guillotin, who was during the French Revolution, as I recall, wanting to provide a more humane and immediate way of killing people. And so there is that history of these kinds of efforts that, of course, bypass the main question.
Well, we're not going to do that. It's entirely too Frenchy. But we did try to institute the electric chair, and it was sold just as medical injections are sold now, as a modern, technological, humane way of killing somebody. In truth, you're basically boiling them or roasting them. That's what you're doing. You're burning people up. It's incredibly painful, subject to all kinds of misfiring. People's hair frequently bursts into flames. But we only acknowledged that after we had a successive method, which seemed more humane.
You were saying much of the what's at stake here is protecting the public from and witnesses at the time from seeing the brutality of executions. These are no longer public political events like in earlier times in history, where a hanging or a public execution was an expression of power, an expression of power on the part of the state or the rulers. Now these are more private affairs.
With the expansion of victims' rights, are allowed to be present at the execution, are allowed to be present. There are a lot of people now watching. There are a lot of inmates entitled to have inmates entitled someone present for him or her. So there are people there, and I think that watching out for them is one of the motives of the antiseptic idea. But in truth, the drugs are all haphazard. It's been phenomenally haphazard. It's never been medically designed. The original one, which was subsequently grabbed by everybody, was designed by a few legislators in the Oklahoma Assembly. That's the source of our current method of killing people.
Now, are the pharmaceutical companies heroes in this story? They're refusing to sell their drugs.
Well, you know, the people like Alita and Scalia claim that these guerrilla warriors against the death penalty have somehow pressed the pharmaceutical companies. These are multi-billion-dollar international companies. He's right that there are guerrilla warriors who want to stop the death penalty, but he's wrong to think they can exert any meaningful pressure on these companies. They are based in Europe. There are legal issues about exporting something which cannot be used in their country because the death penalty is illegal throughout the European Union. So they have problems, and they would, rather than hire brand managers and lawyers to deal with the problem, there's not enough money involved. There's only a handful of executions that take place.
Do the math.
Do the math, right. It's so much easier just to say no.
Well, what about death penalty activists and abolitionists? What's at stake in this recent fight? And what are the risks of focusing too much on finding the right drugs to kill people?
Well, I'm a convert because, you know, I was dubious. It seemed
convert to this fight, you mean?
Absolutely. Yeah, in 2006 in California, they were trying to kill somebody, Michael Morales. And as the execution was unwinding, the two doctors who had agreed to be present and observe to make sure that things worked out were being asked to do more and more and more things to make more decisions. And finally, they realized they were effectively being asked to be executioners. And they decided, we're out of here. And they just abruptly left the chamber. The execution was called off. That was in 2006. There's been nobody executed in California since. It's effective, and it does raise profound issues. What we do is killing people, issues of honesty about what we're actually up to when we're trying to execute, a demonstration of how indefatigable our people are, how hard to kill we are. The lust for life surges up even from the most deepest anesthetics. And now we've got this haphazard anesthetic used to mask a violent burning, which we've tried to mask already by using a muscle paralytic. The whole process and the lack of transparency in it, I think, is very important. It's been very revelatory, and it's taken the battle against the death penalty, along with all the wrongful convictions, a few steps further.
So you see this fight for transparency as more than just requiring attention to the bureaucratic process through which this is achieved, and rather transparency is maybe also a metaphor here for looking more directly at what we're doing, and that these doctors came to realize they were implicated as executionists, but we all are, in a sense, to the extent that we support what this and do not resist what the state is doing and killing people, and the racism that's built into the process of getting there.
Yeah, transparency at every level. Just how racist the system is important. It needs to be more widely known, more closely studied. And the nature of these drugs, it's not that hard. Why do you have these three drugs? Why do you have the paralytic? What's the point of that? It keeps somebody from moving. What if they're excruciating, and they're in excruciating pain, but the paralytic makes it impossible for them to express it? What's that about? Where is the sedative used? Does it work? It's simple questions like, do we have a sedative that actually knocks somebody out, or is it some kind of mask? These are fundamental questions before we even reach larger issues of the propriety of the death penalty. What's going on? What are we trying to hide?
Is there anything instructive about earlier fights around, like, the gas chamber, the electric chair, where opposition to the death penalty was mobilized around that, and then the states changed its procedures, which is not much of a victory?
Well, I can't recall any of the similar energy being brought as to the questions of the electric chair and the gas chamber, but there are, in the wake of more attention being paid to executions, a lot of the problems with the electric chair, for example, surfaced, and a lot of problems with the gas chamber only emerged when people were watching to see what actually happened when you use these methods of killing people.
You know, just in closing, I would recommend that our listeners see the film by Errol Morris, Mr. Death, which is a wonderful account of a guy who is working to create a more humane way of killing people in the electric chair, and how he gets caught in the irrationalities of all of that. It's a kind of morality tale, but just a riveting film.
And the decision, Glossop v. Gross, will be released by the U.S. Supreme Court sometime before the end of June.
So we'll return to that. Okay, this is Jan Hawken and Mike Snedeker talking today about the Supreme Court review of the Oklahoma three-drug execution protocol.
It up, I walk it down. I know not what I do. sword, blade of folded gold.
This is the Old Mole Variety Hour. We conclude today's show with an article by Owen Higgins, 1 Week, 3 Lessons, and the Exclusivity of Exceptionalism in America. Tom Becker is our well-read red this morning. Tom?
Good morning. The trope that justice is blind, that all are equal before the law, has, of course, always been a fiction, but one that is becoming ever more tarnished with dark irony and hypocrisy. Witness the fact that not a single banker or financier who stole millions has served even a day in jail following the 2008 economic crash. Today I'm going to read an article from the Huffington Post website entitled 1 Week, 3 Lessons on the Exclusivity of Exceptionalism in America, Drones, Petraeus, and the Death of Freddie Gray. The article is by Owen Higgins. In the week beginning April 20th, 2015, the American people got 3 object lessons about equal treatment and the stratification of status in the 21st century. 3 events in the week beginning April 20th show convincingly that the American promise of national and global societal justice is a lie. They specifically show that in this new American century, one's economic status, access to power, and place of birth determines one's access to human rights and equal protection under the law. Any illusions to the contrary are just that. The separating of people into groups in which the privileged few look at the disadvantaged other is a byproduct of the extreme nationalism of the modern nation state. The United States has the unique status of being able to apply this othering to not only the underclass in its own society, but also around the globe. Is due to its position as the world's only superpower. The week of April 20th has been particularly noxious in terms of showing the intrinsic injustice in the American system, both on foreign and domestic scale. In truth, the week of the past few decades, any week of the past few decades could also show this. To show the scope and scale of this week's object lessons, we'll forgo chronological order and instead focus on the events broadly to narrowly from global to local. Globally, this week the president took the unprecedented step of confirming publicly that his administration's drone program was responsible for the deaths of 2 Al-Qaeda hostages. One, Warren Weinstein, was a U.S. national, and the other, Giovanni Laporto, was Italian. The president expressed great sorrow at the loss of innocent life and gave his personal condolences to the men's families. A visibly distraught Obama went even further and took direct responsibility for the loss of innocent life. Contrast that attitude with the administration's words on innocent civilians who are not Western nationals and who you'll find a very different take. When the administration acknowledges that attacks kill innocent civilians, those victims are not given the courtesy of being named or even counted. They are instead referred to abstractly, and their deaths are seen as at most a regrettable cost of the war on terror. No public official holds a press conference to admit culpability in their deaths. No public official expresses personal, individualized regret when they express regret at all. On a national level, David Petraeus was sentenced for his role in leaking sensitive documents to his lover for a laudatory biography of him. Given the sentences handed down to such leakers as Chelsea Manning, one might expect Petraeus to face some jail time and severe curtailment of his movement. Instead, of course, Petraeus was sentenced to 2 years of probation and a fine of $100,000. The probation would not stop his freedom to travel across the country to give speeches, where he would earn more than the cost of his fine, and then some, for one such stop. This isn't surprising to anyone who has paid any attention to the politicization of the prosecution of Manning versus the prosecution of Petraeus. For the former, his actions are seen as treason, and his prosecution is met with at least a stony silence. For the latter, after being publicly outed as a philandering leaker of documents for self-aggrandizement, his prosecution is deemed suffered enough, and he is welcomed back to the White House in an advisory role less than 2 years after resigning in disgrace from the CIA and while his trial was ongoing. Locally, it seems that being the son of a prominent Washington politician gives you a license to abuse the police arresting you in ways that have demonstrably led to the death for young men of color in similar situations. Rand Paul's son, William, discovered this on Sunday morning, April 19th, when he was cited, not arrested, for DUI. The younger Paul's behavior was described as belligerent. In spite of that fact, William Paul was released from hospital and not held by police. Contrast that arrest with the arrest and subsequent death in police custody of Freddie Gray of Baltimore. 4 hours before William Paul was cited, Freddie Gray died in a Baltimore area hospital from complications from a spinal column fracture that happened at some point while in police custody. Gray's crime, almost a week prior to his death, was running away from a police detail in a Baltimore neighborhood looking for drug dealers. Somehow, during his arrest and booking, his spinal cord was broken, and he was injured severely enough to kill him less than 7 days later. Contrast that with the treatment of the belligerent Mr. Paul, who was cited and released with no bodily injury. The three examples given here expose the corrupt injustice at the heart of American society. On a global level, the idea of the importance and uniqueness of life being exclusive to the U.S. and her allies leads to the non-Western victims of drone warfare being described in broad terms that rob them of autonomy and individual identity. On the national level, those who, with access to the high reaches of power and influence in the government, get a fraction of the punishment for crimes their lesser connected counterparts can lose years of their lives to. And this bleeds down to the local level, where the same institution that kills a Baltimore man in the course of arresting him for running away frees the rich son of a politician for an actual crime. The relentless othering of the global, national, and local underclass by those in power has consequences. These consequences are obvious. Victims of international aggression are only acknowledged as people when they are Western nationals. Architects of policy have rights and privileges. Those who expose the abuses in the policy do not. A member of the American political aristocracy is treated deferentially for his crime by the institution that kills a poor black man of similar age for no crime at all. If America wants to present itself as the arbitrator of human rights, justice, and upward mobility around the globe and at home, as its leaders constantly assert they do, then societal change is needed desperately. The week of April 20th has shown that to be that fact in stark relief. That was an article entitled One Week, Three Lessons on the Exclusivity of Exceptionalism in America by Owen Higgins. Higgins is a writer and historian from upstate New York. The article can be found on the Huffington Post website.
In the courtroom of honor, the judge pounded his gavel to show that all's equal and that the courts are on the level. And that the strings in the books ain't pulled and persuaded, and that even the nobles get properly handled once that the cops have chased after and caught 'em, and that the ladder of law has no top and no bottom. Stared at the person who killed for no reason, who just happened to be feeling that way without warning. And he spoke through his cloak, most deep and distinguished.
The Lonesome Death of Hattie Carroll, Bob Dylan. This has been the Old Mole Variety Hour on KBOO Radio 90.7 FM in Portland, Oregon. It is a collective labor that brings you the Old Mole every Monday morning at 9 a.m. Thanks to our Old Mole contributors and guests, Bill Resnick and Dave Finkel, Larry Bolden, Tom Becker, Jan Hawken, and Mike Snedeker. I'm your host, Denise Morris. Our engineer this morning is Patsy Kohlberg. Coming up on KBOO this morning, we have Locus Focus at 10:15. Actually, let's start over. We've got Air Cascadia on at 10. Then it's Locus Focus at 10:15. That's with host Barbara Bernstein. Today's guest is David Bielow, Associate Editor for Environment and Energy at Scientific American. They discuss consequences of using geoengineering to solve our carbon emissions problems. At 11, we'll hear Health Watch with Dr. David Naiman. Today's guest is Dan Buettner, author of The Blue Zone Solution, about finding the best health practices across the planet. And at 11:30, we'll hear Madness Radio with host Will Hall, who brings us voices and visions from outside mental health. Thanks for listening this morning, and we're back next week.
Donate today to be entered into KBOO Spring Sweepstakes. One lucky person will win a six-month VIP pass to the Crystal Ballroom, a week-long artist residency at Southwestern Lodge, $200 in gift certificates to Portland Saturday Market, and 10 treatments to working-class acupuncture. A donation is not required to enter. All money raised will be applied to KBOO's Spring Membership Drive goal of $95,000. For every $15,000 raised before May 5th, we will shorten the drive by one day. To learn more, go to kboo.fm.
Cascadia. Today is Monday, May 4th, 2015, and you're listening to KBOO Portland, your community radio at 90.7 FM, kboo.fm on the web. And don't forget, membership drive is right round the corner. KBOO needs you like never before, just as you no doubt need KBOO, your community voice. This morning, we are very fortunate to have, I might add, Robert McRae. He's been on the show before. He is the Council on American Islamic Relations Government Affairs Manager. So he'll be joining us today to talk about some of the factors that contributed to yet another insane sentence.